cruelty time had treated them since the last occasion when they had seen each other undressed. Ildebranda was large and solid, with golden skin, but all the hair on her body was like a mulata's, as short and curly as steel wool. Fermina Daza, on the other hand, had a pale nakedness, with long lines, serene skin, and straight hair. Gala Placidia had two identical beds placed in the bedroom, but at times they lay together in one and talked in the dark until dawn. They smoked long, thin highwaymen's cigars that Ildebranda had hidden in the lining of her trunk, and afterward they had to burn Armenian paper to purify the rank smell they left behind in the bedroom. Fermina Daza had smoked for the first time in Valledupar, and had continued in Fonseca and Riohacha, where as many as 10 cousins would lock themselves in a room to talk about men and to smoke. She learned to smoke backward, with the lit end in her mouth, the way men smoked at night during the wars, so that the glow of their cigarettes would not betray them. But she had never smoked alone. With Ildebranda in her house, she smoked every night before going to sleep, and it was then that she acquired the habit, although she always hid it, even from her husband and her children, not only because it was thought improper for a woman to smoke in public, but because she associated the pleasure with secrecy. Ildebranda's trip had also been imposed by her parents in an effort to put distance between her and her impossible love, although they wanted her to think that it was to help Fermina decide on a good match. Ildebranda had accepted, hoping to mock forgetfulness as her cousin had done before her, and she had arranged with the telegraph operator in Fonseca to send her messages with the greatest prudence. And that is why her disillusion was so bitter when she learned that Fermina Daza had rejected Florentino Ariza. Moreover, Ildebranda had a universal conception of love, and she believed that whatever happened to one love affected all other loves throughout the world. Still, she did not renounce her plan. With an audacity that caused a crisis of dismay in Fermina Daza, she went to the telegraph office alone, intending to win the favor of Florentino Ariza. She would not have recognized him, for there was nothing about him that corresponded to the image she had formed from Fermina Daza. At first glance, it seemed impossible that her cousin could have been on the verge of madness because of that almost invisible clerk with his air of a whipped dog, whose clothing, worthy of a rabbi in disgrace, and whose solemn manner could not perturb anyone's heart. But she soon repented of her first impression, for Florentino Ariza placed himself at her unconditional service without knowing who she was. He never found out. No one could have understood her as he did, so that he did not ask for identification or even for her address. His solution was very simple. She would pass by the telegraph office on Wednesday afternoons so that he could place her lover's answers in her hand, and nothing more. And yet when he read the written message that Ildebranda brought him, he asked if she would accept a suggestion, and she agreed. Florentino Ariza first made some corrections between the lines, erased them, rewrote them, had no more room, and at last tore up the page and wrote a completely new message that she thought very touching. When she left the telegraph office, Ildebranda was on the verge of tears.
"He is ugly and sad," she said to Fermina Daza, "but he is all love."
What most struck Ildebranda was her cousin's solitude. She seemed, she told her, an old maid of 20. Accustomed to large, scattered families in houses where no one was certain how many people were living or eating at any given time, Ildebranda could not imagine a girl her age reduced to the cloister of a private life. That was true. From the time she awoke at 6 in the morning until she turned out the light in the bedroom, Fermina Daza devoted herself to killing time. Life was imposed on her from outside. First, at the final rooster crow, the milkman woke her with his rapping on the door knocker. Then came the knock of the fishwife with her box of red snappers dying on a bed of algae, the sumptuous fruit sellers with vegetables from Maria La Baja and fruit from San Jacinto. And then, for the rest of the day, everyone knocked at the door. Beggars, girls with lottery tickets, the Sisters of Charity, the knife grinder with the gossip, the man who bought bottles, the man who bought old gold, the man who bought newspapers, the fake gypsies who offered to read one's destiny in cards, in the lines of one's palm, in coffee grounds, in the water in wash basins. Gala Placidia spent the week opening and closing the street door to say no, another day, or shouting from the balcony in a foul humor to stop bothering us, damn it, we already bought everything we need. She had replaced Aunt Escolastica with so much fervor and so much grace that Fermina confused them to the point of loving her. She had the obsessions of a slave. Whenever she had free time, she would go to the workroom to iron the linens. She kept them perfect. She kept them in cupboards with lavender, and she ironed and folded not only what she had just washed, but also what might have lost its brightness through disuse. With the same care, she continued to maintain the wardrobe of Fermina Sanchez, Fermina's mother, who had died 14 years before. But Fermina Daza was the one who made the decisions. She ordered what they would eat, what they would buy, what had to be done in every circumstance, and in that way she determined the life in a house where in reality nothing had to be determined. When she finished washing the cages and feeding the birds and making certain that the flowers wanted for nothing, she was at a loss. Often, after she was expelled from school, she would fall asleep at siesta and not wake up until the next day. The painting classes were only a more amusing way to kill time. Her relationship with her father had lacked affection since the expulsion of Aunt Escolastica, although they had found the way to live together without bothering each other. When she awoke, he had already gone to his business. He rarely missed the ritual of lunch, although he almost never ate, for the aperitifs and Galician appetizers at the parish café satisfied him. He did not eat supper either. They left his meal on the table, everything on one plate covered by another, although they knew that he would not eat it until the next day when it was reheated for his breakfast. Once a week he gave his daughter money for expenses, which he calculated with care and she administered with rigor. But he listened with pleasure to any request she might make for unforeseen expenses. He never questioned a penny she spent. He never asked her for any explanations. But she behaved as if she had to make an accounting before the tribunal of the Holy Office. He had never spoken to her about the nature or condition of his business, and he had never taken her to his offices in the port, which were in a location forbidden to decent young ladies, even if accompanied by their fathers. Lorenzo Daza did not come home before 10 o'clock at night, which was the curfew hour during the less critical periods of the wars. Until that time, he would stay at the parish café, playing one game or another, for he was an expert in all salon games and a good teacher as well. He always came home sober, not disturbing his daughter, despite the fact that he had his first anisette when he awoke, and continued chewing the end of his unlit cigar and drinking at regular intervals throughout the day. One night, however, Fermina heard him come in. She heard his Cossack step on the stair, his heavy breathing in the second-floor hallway, his pounding with the flat of his hand on her bedroom door. She opened it, and for the first time she was frightened by his twisted eye and the slurring of his words.
"We are ruined," he said. "Total ruin. So now you know."
That was all he said, and he never said it again. And nothing happened to indicate whether he had told the truth. But after that night, Fermina Daza knew that she was alone in the world. She lived in a social limbo. Her former schoolmates were in a heaven that was closed to her, above all after the dishonor of her expulsion. And she was not a neighbor to her neighbors, because they had known her without a past, in the uniform of the Academy of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin. Her father's world was one of traders and stevedores, of war refugees in the public shelter of the parish café, of solitary men. In the last year, the painting classes had alleviated her seclusion somewhat, for the teacher preferred group classes and would bring the other pupils to the sewing room. But they were girls of varying and undefined social circumstances, And for Fermina Daza, they were no more than borrowed friends whose affection ended with each class. Ildebranda wanted to open the house, air it, bring in her father's musicians and fireworks and castles of gunpowder, and have a carnival dance whose gale winds would clear out her cousin's moth-eaten spirit. But she soon realized that her proposals were to no avail, and for a very simple reason. There was no one to invite. In any case, it was she who thrust Fermina Daza into life. In the afternoon, after the painting classes, she allowed herself to be taken out to see the city. Fermina Daza showed her the route she had taken every day with Aunt Escolastica, the bench in the little park where Florentino Arisa pretended to read while he waited for her, the narrow streets along which he followed her, the hiding places for their letters, the sinister palace where the prison of the Holy Office had been located, later restored and converted into the Academy of the Presentation of the Blessed Virgin, which he hated with all her soul. They climbed the hill of the pauper cemetery, where Florentino Arisa played the violin according to the direction of the winds so that she could listen to him in bed, and from there they viewed the entire historic city, the broken roofs and the decaying walls, the rubble of fortresses among the brambles, the trail of islands in the bay, the hovels of the poor around the swamps, the immense Caribbean. On Christmas Eve, they went to midnight mass in the cathedral. Fermina sat where she used to hear Florentino Arisa's confidential music with greatest clarity, and she showed her cousin the exact spot where, on a night like this, she had seen his frightened eyes up close for the first time. They ventured alone as far as the Arcade of the Scribes. They bought sweets. They were amused in the shop that sold fancy paper. And Fermina Daza showed her cousin the place where she suddenly discovered that her love was nothing more than an illusion. She herself had not realized that every step she took from her house to school, every spot in the city, every moment of her recent past, did not seem to exist except by the grace of Florentino Arisa. Ildebranda pointed this out to her, but she did not admit it, because she never would have admitted that Florentino Arisa, for better or for worse, was the only thing that had ever happened to her in her life. It was during this time that a Belgian photographer came to the city and set up his studio at the end of the Arcade of the Scribes, and all those with the money to pay took advantage of the opportunity to have their pictures taken. Fermina and Ildebranda were among the first. They emptied Fermina Sanchez's clothes closet. They shared the finest dresses, the parasols, the party shoes, the hats, and they dressed as mid-century ladies. Gala Placidia helped them lace up the corsets. She showed them how to move inside the wire frames of the hoop skirts, how to wear the gloves, how to button the high-heeled boots. Ildebranda preferred a broad-brimmed hat with ostrich feathers that hung down over her shoulder. Fermina wore a more recent model, decorated with painted plaster fruit and crinoline flowers. At last they giggled when they looked in the mirror and saw the resemblance to the daguerreotypes of their grandmothers, and they went off happy, laughing for all they were worth, to have the photograph of their lives taken. Gala Placidia watched from the balcony as they crossed the park with their parasols open, tottering on their high heels and pushing against the hoop skirts with their bodies as if they were children's walkers, and she gave them her blessing so that God would help them in their portraits. There was a mob in front of the Belgian studio, because photographs were being taken of Benny Centeno, who had won the boxing championship in Panama. He wore his boxing trunks and his boxing gloves and his crown, and it was not easy to photograph him because he had to hold a fighting stance for a whole minute and breathe as little as possible. But as soon as he put up his guard, his fans burst into cheers, and he could not resist the temptation to please them by showing off his skill. When it was the cousin's turn, the sky had clouded over and rain seemed imminent, but they allowed their faces to be powdered with starch, and they leaned against an alabaster column with such ease that they remained motionless for more time than seemed reasonable. It was an immortal portrait.
When Ildebranda died on a ranch at Flores de Maria, when she was almost 100 years old, they found her copy locked in the bedroom closet, hidden among the folds of the perfumed sheets, along with the fossil of a thought in a letter that had faded with time. For many years, Fermina Daza kept hers on the first page of a family album. Then it disappeared without anyone's knowing how or when, and came into the possession of Florentino Ariza through a series of unbelievable coincidences when they were both over 60 years old. When Fermina and Ildebranda came out of the Belgian studio, there were so many people in the plaza across from the Arcade of the Scribes that even the balconies were crowded. They had forgotten that their faces were white with starch and that their lips were painted with a chocolate-colored salve and that their clothes were not appropriate to the time of day or the age. The street greeted them with catcalls and mockery. They were cornered, trying to escape public derision, when the landau drawn by the golden chestnuts opened a path through the crowd. The catcalls ceased and the hostile groups dispersed. Ildebranda was never to forget her first sight of the man who appeared on the footboard. His satin top hat, his brocaded vest, his knowing gestures, the sweetness in his eyes, the authority of his presence. Although she had never seen him before, she recognized him immediately. The previous month, Fermina Daza had spoken about him in an offhand way and with no sign of interest, one afternoon when she did not want to pass by the house of the Marquis de Casalduero because the landau with the golden horses was stopped in front of the door. She told her who the owner was and attempted to explain the reasons for her antipathy, although she did not say a word about his courting her. Ildebranda thought no more about him. But when she identified him as a vision out of legend, standing in the carriage door with one foot on the ground and the other on the footboard, she could not understand her cousin's motives.
"Please get in," said Dr. Juvenal Urbino. "I will take you wherever you want to go."
Fermina Daza began a gesture of refusal, but Ildebranda had already accepted. Dr. Juvenal Urbino jumped down, and with his fingertips, almost without touching her, he helped her into the carriage. Fermina had no alternative but to climb in after her, her face blazing with embarrassment. The house was only 3 blocks away. The cousins did not realize that Dr. Urbino had given instructions to the coachman, but he must have done so because it took the carriage almost half an hour to reach its destination. The girls were on the principal seat, and he sat opposite them, facing the back of the carriage. Fermina turned her head toward the window and was lost in the void. Ildebranda, on the other hand, was delighted, and Dr. Urbino was even more delighted by her delight. As soon as the carriage began to move, she sensed the warm odor of the leather seats, the intimacy of the padded interior, and she said that it seemed a nice place to spend the rest of one's life. Very soon they began to laugh, to exchange jokes as if they were old friends, and they began to match wits in a simple word game that consisted of placing a nonsense syllable after every other syllable. They pretended that Fermina did not understand them, although they knew she not only understood but was listening as well, which is why they did it. After much laughter, Ildebranda confessed that she could no longer endure the torture of her boots.
"Nothing could be simpler," said Dr. Urbino.
"Let us see who finishes first." He began to unlace his own boots, and Ildebranda accepted the challenge. It was not easy for her to do because the stays in the corset did not allow her to bend, but Dr. Urbino dallied until she took her boots out from under her skirt with a triumphant laugh, as if she had just fished them out of a pond. Then both of them looked at Fermina, and saw her magnificent golden oriole's profile sharper than ever against the blaze of the setting sun. She was furious for 3 reasons. Because of the undeserved situation in which she found herself, because of Ildebranda's libertine behavior, and because she was certain that the carriage was driving in circles in order to postpone their arrival. But Ildebranda had lost all restraint.
"Now I realize," she said, "that what bothered me was not my shoes, but this wire cage."
Dr. Urbino understood that she was referring to her hoop skirt, and he seized the opportunity as it flew by.
"Nothing could be simpler," he said. "Take it off."
With the rapid movements of a prestidigitator, he removed his handkerchief from his pocket and covered his eyes with it.
"I won't look," he said.
The blindfold emphasized the purity of his lips, surrounded by his round black beard and his mustache with the wax tips, and she felt herself shaken by a sudden surge of panic. She looked at Fermina, and now she saw that she was not furious, but terrified that she might be capable of taking off her skirt. Ildebranda became serious and asked her in sign language, "What shall we do?" Fermina answered in the same code that if they did not go straight home, she would throw herself out of the moving carriage.
"I am waiting," said the doctor.
"You can look now," said Ildebranda. When Dr. Juvenal Urbino removed the blindfold, he found her changed, and he understood that the game had ended and had not ended well. At a sign from him, the coachman turned the carriage around and drove into the Park of the Evangels, just as the lamplighter was making his rounds. All the churches were ringing the Angelus. Ildebranda hurried out of the carriage, somewhat disturbed at the idea that she had offended her cousin, and she said goodbye to the doctor with a perfunctory handshake. Fermina did the same, but when she tried to withdraw her hand in its satin glove, Dr. Urbino squeezed her ring finger.
"I am waiting for your answer," he said.
Then Fermina pulled harder, and her empty glove was left dangling in the doctor's hand, but she did not wait to retrieve it. She went to bed without eating. Ildebranda, as if nothing had happened, came into the bedroom after her supper with Galla Placidia in the kitchen, and with her inborn wit, commented on the events of the afternoon. She did not attempt to hide her enthusiasm for Dr. Urbino, for his elegance and charm, and Fermina refused to comment but was brimming with anger. At one point, Ildebranda confessed that when Dr. Juvenal Urbino covered his eyes and she saw the splendor of his perfect teeth between his rosy lips, she had felt an irresistible desire to devour him with kisses. Fermina Daza turned to the wall and, with no wish to offend, but smiling and with all her heart, put an end to the conversation. "What a whore you are," she said. Her sleep was restless. She saw Dr. Juvenal Urbino everywhere. She saw him laughing, singing, emitting sulphurous sparks from between his teeth with his eyes blindfolded, mocking her with a word game that had no fixed rules, driving up to the pauper's cemetery in a different carriage. She awoke long before dawn and lay exhausted and wakeful with her eyes closed, thinking of the countless years she still had to live. Later, while Ildebranda was bathing, she wrote a letter as quickly as possible, folded it as quickly as possible, put it in an envelope as quickly as possible, and before Ildebranda came out of the bathroom, she had Galla Placidia deliver it to Dr. Juvenal Urbino. It was one of her typical letters, not a syllable too many or too few, in which she told the doctor, yes, he could speak to her father. When Florentino Arisa learned that Fermina Daza was going to marry a physician with family and fortune, educated in Europe, and with an extraordinary reputation for a man of his years, there was no power on earth that could raise him from his prostration. Tránsito Arisa did all she could and more, using all the stratagems of a sweetheart to console him when she realized that he had lost his speech and his appetite and was spending nights on end in constant weeping, and by the end of the week, he was eating again. Then she spoke to Don Leo XII Loaysa, the only one of the three brothers who was still alive, and without telling him the reason, she pleaded with him to give his nephew any job at all in the navigation company, as long as it was in a port lost in the jungle of the Magdalena, where there was no mail and no telegraph, and no one who would tell him anything about this damnable city. His uncle did not give him the job out of deference to his brother's widow, for she could not bear the very existence of her husband's illegitimate son, but he did find him employment as a telegraph operator in Villa de Leyva, a dreamy city more than 20 days' journey away and almost 3,000 meters above the level of the Street of Windows.
Florentino Arisa was never very conscious of that curative journey. He would remember it always, as he remembered everything that happened during that period, through the rarefied lenses of his misfortune. When he received the telegram informing him of his appointment, it did not even occur to him to consider it. But Lothario Tugut convinced him with Germanic arguments that a brilliant career awaited him in public administration. He told him, "The telegraph is the profession of the future." He gave him a pair of gloves lined with rabbit fur, a hat worthy of the steppes, and an overcoat with a plush collar, tried and proven in the icy winters of Bavaria. Uncle Leo XII gave him 2 serge suits and a pair of waterproof boots that had belonged to his older brother, and he also gave him cabin passage on the next boat. Tránsito Arisa altered the clothing and made it smaller for her son, who was less corpulent than his father and much shorter than the German, and she bought him woolen socks and long underwear so that he would have everything he needed to resist the rigors of the mountain wastelands. Florentino Arisa, hardened by so much suffering, attended to the preparations for his journey as if he were a dead man attending to the preparations for his own funeral. The same iron hermeticism with which he had revealed to no one but his mother the secret of his repressed passion meant that he did not tell anyone he was going away and did not say goodbye to anyone. But on the eve of his departure, he committed, with full awareness, a final mad act of the heart that might well have cost him his life. At midnight he put on his Sunday suit and went to stand alone under Fermina Daza's balcony to play the love waltz he had composed for her, which was known only to the two of them, and which for 3 years had been the emblem of their frustrated complicity. He played, murmuring the words, his violin bathed in tears, with an inspiration so intense that with the first measures the dogs on the street and then the dogs all over the city began to howl. But then, little by little, they were quieted by the spell of the music, and the waltz ended in supernatural silence. The balcony did not open, and no one appeared on the street, not even the night watchman, who almost always came running with his oil lamp in an effort to profit in some small way from serenades. The act was an exorcism of relief for Florentino Arisa, for when he put the violin back into its case and walked down the dead streets without looking back, he no longer felt that he was leaving the next morning, but that he had gone away many years before, with the irrevocable determination never to return. The boat, one of 3 identical vessels belonging to the River Company of the Caribbean, had been renamed in honor of the founder, Pius V Loaysa. It was a floating 2-story wooden house on a wide, level iron hull, and its maximum draft of 5 feet allowed it to negotiate the variable depths of the river. The older boats had been built in Cincinnati in mid-century, on the legendary model of the vessels that traveled the Ohio and the Mississippi, with a wheel on each side powered by a wood-fed boiler. Like them, the boats of the River Company of the Caribbean had a lower deck almost level with the water. With the steam engines and the galleys and the sleeping quarters like hen houses where the crew hung their hammocks crisscrossed at different heights. On the upper deck were the bridge, the cabins of the captain and his officers, and a recreation and dining room, where notable passengers were invited at least once to have dinner and play cards. On the middle deck were 6 first-class cabins on either side of a passage that served as a common dining room, and in the prow was a sitting room open to the river, with carved wood railings and iron columns, where most of the passengers hung their hammocks at night. Unlike the older boats, these did not have paddle wheels at the sides. Instead, there was an enormous wheel with horizontal paddles at the stern, just underneath the suffocating toilets on the passenger deck. Florentino Arisa had not taken the trouble to explore the boat when he came aboard on a Sunday in July at 7 o'clock in the morning, as those traveling for the first time did almost by instinct. He became aware of his new milieu only at dusk,
as they were sailing past the hamlet of Calamar, when he went to the stern to urinate and saw, through the opening in the toilet, the gigantic paddle wheel turning under his feet with a volcanic display of foam and steam. He had never traveled before. He had with him a tin trunk with his clothes for the mountain wastelands, the illustrated novels that he bought in pamphlet form every month and that he himself sewed into cardboard covers, and the books of love poetry that he recited from memory and that were about to crumble into dust with so much reading. He had left behind his violin, for he identified it too closely with his misfortune, but his mother had obliged him to take his petate, a very popular and practical bedroll, with its pillow, sheet, small pewter chamber pot, and mosquito netting, all of this wrapped in straw matting tied with two hemp ropes for hanging a hammock in an emergency. Florentino Ariza had not wanted to take it, for he thought it would be useless in a cabin that provided bed and bedclothes. But from the very first night, he had reason once again to be grateful for his mother's good sense. At the last moment, a passenger dressed in evening clothes boarded the boat. He had arrived early that morning on a ship from Europe and was accompanied by the provincial governor himself. He wanted to continue his journey without delay, along with his wife and daughter and liveried servant and seven trunks with gold fittings, which were almost too bulky for the stairway. To accommodate the unexpected travelers, the captain, a giant from Curaçao, called on the passengers' indigenous sense of patriotism. In a jumble of Spanish and Curaçao patois, he explained to Florentino Ariza that the man in evening dress was the new plenipotentiary from England, on his way to the capital of the Republic. He reminded him of how that kingdom had provided us with decisive resources in our struggle for independence from Spanish rule, and that as a consequence, no sacrifice was too great if it would allow a family of such distinction to feel more at home in our country than in their own. Florentino Ariza, of course, gave up his cabin. At first he did not regret it, for the river was high at that time of year, and the boat navigated without any difficulty for the first two nights. After dinner at 5 o'clock, the crew distributed folding canvas cots to the passengers, and each person opened his bed wherever he could find room, arranged it with the bedclothes from his petate, and set the mosquito netting over that. Those with hammocks hung them in the salon, and those who had nothing slept on the tables in the dining room, wrapped in the tablecloths that were not changed more than twice during the trip. Florentino Ariza was awake most of the night, thinking that he heard the voice of Fermina Daza in the fresh river breeze, ministering to his solitude with her memory, hearing her sing in the respiration of the boat as it moved like a great animal through the darkness, until the first rosy streaks appeared on the horizon, and the new day suddenly broke over deserted pasture land and misty swamps. Then his journey seemed yet another proof of his mother's wisdom, and he felt that he had the fortitude to endure forgetting. After 3 days of favorable water, however, it became more difficult to navigate between inopportune sandbanks and deceptive rapids. The river turned muddy and grew narrower and narrower in a tangled jungle of colossal trees, where there was only an occasional straw hut next to the piles of wood for the ship's boilers. The screeching of the parrots and the chattering of the invisible monkeys seemed to intensify the midday heat. At night, it was necessary to anchor the boat in order to sleep, and then the simple fact of being alive became unendurable. To the heat and the mosquitoes was added the reek of strips of salted meat hung to dry on the railings. Most of the passengers, above all the Europeans, abandoned the pestilential stench of their cabins and spent the night walking the decks, brushing away all sorts of predatory creatures with the same towel they used to dry their incessant perspiration, and at dawn they were exhausted and swollen with bites. Moreover, another episode of the intermittent civil war between liberals and conservatives had broken out that year, and the captain had taken very strict precautions to maintain internal order and protect the safety of the passengers. Trying to avoid misunderstandings and provocations, He prohibited the favorite pastime during river voyages in those days, which was to shoot the alligators sunning themselves on the broad, sandy banks. Later on, when some of the passengers divided into two opposing camps during an argument, he confiscated everyone's weapons and gave his word of honor that they would be returned at the end of the journey. He was inflexible even with the British minister, who, on the morning following their departure, appeared in a hunting outfit with a precision carbine and a double-barreled rifle for killing tigers. The restrictions became even more drastic above the port of Tenerife, where they passed a boat flying the yellow plague flag. The captain could not obtain any further information regarding that alarming sign, because the other vessel did not respond to his signals. But that same day, they encountered another boat with a cargo of cattle for Jamaica, and were informed that the vessel with the plague flag was carrying two people sick with cholera, and that the epidemic was wreaking havoc along the portion of the river they still had to travel. Then the passengers were prohibited from leaving the boat, not only in the ports, but even in the uninhabited places where they stopped to take on wood. So that until they reached the final port, a trip of 6 days, the passengers acquired the habits of prisoners, including the pernicious contemplation of a packet of pornographic Dutch postcards that circulated from hand to hand without anyone's knowing where it came from, although no veteran of the river was unaware that this was only a tiny sampling of the captain's legendary collection. But in the end, even that distraction, with no expectation, only increased the tedium. Florentino Ariza endured the hardships of the journey with the mineral patience that had brought sorrow to his mother and exasperation to his friends. He spoke to no one. The days were easy for him as he sat at the rail, watching the motionless alligators sunning themselves on sandy banks, their mouths open to catch butterflies, watching the flocks of startled herons that rose without warning from the marshes, the manatees that nursed their young at large maternal teats and startled the passengers with their woman's cries. On a single day, he saw three bloated green human corpses float past, with buzzards sitting on them. First, the bodies of two men went by, one of them without a head, and then a very young girl whose Medusan locks undulated in the boat's wake. He never knew, because no one ever knew, if they were victims of the cholera or the war. But the nauseating stench contaminated his memory of Fermina Daza. That was always the case. Any event, good or bad, had some relationship to her. At night, when the boat was anchored and most of the passengers walked the decks in despair, he perused the illustrated novels he knew almost by heart under the carbide lamp in the dining room, which was the only one kept burning until dawn, and the dramas he had read so often regained their original magic when he replaced the imaginary protagonists with people he knew in real life, reserving for himself and Fermina Daza the roles of star-crossed lovers. On other nights, he wrote anguished letters and then scattered their fragments over the water that flowed toward her without pause. And so the most difficult hours passed for him, at times in the person of a timid prince or a paladin of love, at other times in his own scalded hide of a lover in the middle of forgetting, until the first breezes began to blow, and he went to doze in the lounge chairs by the railing. One night, when he stopped his reading earlier than usual and was walking, distracted, toward the toilets, a door opened as he passed through the dining room, and a hand like the talon of a hawk seized him by the shirt sleeve and pulled him into a cabin. In the darkness, he could barely see the naked woman, her ageless body soaked in hot perspiration, her breathing heavy, who pushed him onto the bunk face up, unbuckled his belt, unbuttoned his trousers, impaled herself on him as if she were riding horseback, and stripped him, without glory, of his virginity. Both of them fell, in an agony of desire, into the void of a bottomless pit that smelled of a salt marsh full of prawns. Then she lay for a moment on top of him, gasping for breath, and she ceased to exist in the darkness. "Now, go and forget all about it," she said. This never happened.
The assault had been so rapid and so triumphant that it could only be understood not as a sudden madness caused by boredom, but as the fruit of a plan elaborated over time and down to its smallest detail. This gratifying certainty increased Florentino Ariza's eagerness, for at the height of pleasure, he had experienced a revelation that he could not believe, that he even refused to admit, which was that his illusory love for Fermina Daza could be replaced by an earthly passion. And so it was that he felt compelled to discover the identity of the mistress of violation in whose panther's instincts he might find the cure for his misfortune. But he was not successful. On the contrary, the more he delved into the search, the further he felt from the truth. The assault had taken place in the last cabin, but this communicated with the one next to it by a door, so that the two rooms had been converted into family sleeping quarters with four bunks. The occupants were two young women, another who was rather mature but very attractive, and an infant a few months old. They had boarded in Barranco de Loba, the port where cargo and passengers from Mompox were picked up, ever since that city had been excluded from the itineraries of the steamboats because of the river's caprices. And Florentino Ariza had noticed them only because they carried the sleeping child in a large birdcage. They dressed as if they were traveling on a fashionable ocean liner, with bustles under their silk skirts and lace gorgets and broad-brimmed hats trimmed with crinoline flowers, and the two younger women changed their entire outfits several times a day, so that they seemed to carry with them their own spring-like ambience, while the other passengers were suffocating in the heat. All three were skilled in the use of parasols and feathered fans, but their intentions were as indecipherable as those of other women from Mompox. Florentino Ariza could not even determine their relationship to one another, although he had no doubt they came from the same family. At first he thought that the older one might be the mother of the other two, but then he realized she was not old enough for that, and that she also wore partial mourning that the others did not share. He could not imagine that one of them would have dared to do what she did while the others were sleeping in the nearby bunks, and the only reasonable supposition was that she had taken advantage of a fortuitous or perhaps prearranged moment when she was alone in the cabin. He observed that at times two of them stayed out for a breath of cool air until very late, while the third remained behind, caring for the infant. But one night, when it was very hot, all three of them left the cabin, carrying the baby who was asleep in the wicker cage covered with gauze. Despite the tangle of clues, Florentino Ariza soon rejected the possibility that the oldest had been the perpetrator of the assault, and with as much dispatch he also absolved the youngest, who was the most beautiful and the boldest of the three. He did so without valid reasons, but only because his avid observations of the three women had persuaded him to accept as truth the profound hope that his sudden lover was in fact the mother of the caged infant. That supposition was so seductive that he began to think about her with more intensity than he thought about Fermina Daza, ignoring the evidence that this recent mother lived only for her child. She was no more than 25. She was slender and golden. She had Portuguese eyelids that made her seem even more aloof. And any man would have been satisfied with only the crumbs of the tenderness that she lavished on her son. From breakfast until bedtime, she was busy with him in the salon, while the other two played Chinese checkers, and when at last she managed to put him to sleep, she would hang the wicker cage from the ceiling on the cooler side of the railing. She did not ignore him, however, even when he was asleep, but would rock the cage, singing love songs under her breath, while her thoughts flew high above the miseries of the journey. Florentino Ariza clung to the illusion that sooner or later she would betray herself, if only with a gesture. He even observed the changes in her breathing, watching the reliquary that hung on her batiste blouse as he looked at her without dissimulation over the book he pretended to read, and he committed the calculated impertinence of changing his seat in the dining room so that he would face her. But he could not find the slightest hint that she was, in fact, the repository of the other half of his secret.
The only thing of hers he had, and that only because her younger companion called to her, was her first name, Rosalba. On the eighth day, the boat navigated with great difficulty through a turbulent strait squeezed between marble cliffs, and after lunch it anchored in Puerto Nare. This was the disembarkation point for those passengers who would continue their journey into Antioquia, one of the provinces most affected by the new civil war. The port consisted of half a dozen palm huts and a store made of wood with a zinc roof, and it was protected by several squads of barefoot and ill-armed soldiers because there had been rumors of a plan by the insurrectionists to plunder the boats. Behind the houses, reaching to the sky, rose a promontory of uncultivated highland with a wrought-iron cornice at the edge of the precipice. No one on board slept well that night, but the attack did not materialize, and in the morning the port was transformed into a Sunday fair, with Indians selling thagua amulets and love potions amid packs of animals ready to begin the six-day ascent to the orchid jungles of the central mountain range. Florentino Ariza passed the time watching black men unload the boat onto their backs. He watched them carry off crates of china and pianos for the spinsters of Envigado. And he did not realize it until it was too late that Rosalba and her party were among the passengers who had stayed on shore. He saw them when they were already sitting side-saddle with their Amazon's boots and their parasols in equatorial colors. And then he took the step he had not dared to take during the preceding days. He waved goodbye to Rosalba, and the three women responded in kind, with a familiarity that cut him to the quick because his boldness came too late. He saw them round the corner of the store, followed by the mules carrying their trunks, their hat boxes, and the baby's cage, and soon afterward he saw them ascend along the edge of the precipice like a line of ants and disappear from his life. Then he felt alone in the world, and the memory of Fermina Daza, lying in ambush in recent days, dealt him a mortal blow. He knew that she was to have an elaborate wedding, and then the being who loved her most, who would love her forever, would not even have the right to die for her. Jealousy, which until that time had been drowned in weeping, took possession of his soul. He prayed to God that the lightning of divine justice would strike Fermina Daza as she was about to give a vow of love and obedience to a man who wanted her for his wife only as a social adornment, and he went into rapture at the vision of the bride, his bride or no one's, lying face up on the flagstones of the cathedral, her orange blossoms laden with the dew of death, and the foaming torrent of her veil covering the funerary marbles of the 14 bishops who were buried in front of the main altar. Once his revenge was consummated, however, he repented of his own wickedness. And then he saw Fermina Daza rising from the ground, her spirit intact, distant but alive, because it was not possible for him to imagine the world without her. He did not sleep again. And if at times he sat down to pick at food, it was in the hope that Fermina Daza would be at the table, or, conversely, to deny her the homage of fasting for her sake. At times his solace was the certainty that during the intoxication of her wedding celebration, even during the feverish nights of her honeymoon, Fermina Daza would suffer one moment, one at least, but one in any event, when the phantom of the sweetheart she had scorned, humiliated and insulted, would appear in her thoughts, and all her happiness would be destroyed. The night before they reached the port of Caracolí, which was the end of the journey, the captain gave the traditional farewell party, with a woodwind orchestra composed of crew members and fireworks from the bridge. The minister from Great Britain had survived the Odyssey with exemplary stoicism, shooting with his camera the animals that they would not allow him to kill with his rifles, and not a night went by that he was not seen in evening dress in the dining room. But he came to the final party wearing the tartans of the MacTavish clan, and he played the bagpipe for everyone's entertainment
and taught those who were interested how to dance his national dances, and before daybreak he almost had to be carried to his cabin. Florentino Ariza, prostrate with grief, had gone to the farthest corner of the deck, where the noise of the revelry could not reach him, and he put on Lotario Tugut's overcoat in an effort to overcome the shivering in his bones. He had awakened at 5 that morning, as the condemned man awakens at dawn on the day of his execution, and for that entire day he had done nothing but imagine, minute by minute, each of the events at Fermina Daza's wedding. Later, when he returned home, he realized that he had made a mistake in the time, and that everything had been different from what he had imagined, and he even had the good sense to laugh at his fantasy. But in any case, it was a Saturday of passion, which culminated in a new crisis of fever when he thought the moment had come for the newlyweds to flee in secret through a false door to give themselves over to the delights of their first night. Someone saw him shivering with fever and informed the captain, who, fearing a case of cholera, left the party with the ship's doctor, and the doctor took the precaution of sending Florentino to the quarantine cabin with a dose of bromides. The next day, however, when they sighted the cliffs of Caracolí, his fever had disappeared and his spirits were elated, because in the marasmus of the sedatives he had resolved once and for all that he did not give a damn about the brilliant future of the telegraph, and that he would take this very same boat back to his old street of windows. It was not difficult to persuade them to give him return passage in exchange for the cabin he had surrendered to the representative of Queen Victoria. The captain also attempted to dissuade him, arguing that the telegraph was the science of the future. So much so, he said, that they were already devising a system for installing it on boats. But he resisted all arguments, and in the end, the captain took him home. Not because he owed him the price of the cabin, but because he knew of his excellent connections to the River Company of the Caribbean. The trip downriver took less than 6 days, and Florentino Ariza felt that he was home again from the moment they entered Mercedes Lagoon at dawn, and he saw the trail of lights on the fishing canoes undulating in the wake of the boat. It was still dark when they docked in Niño Perdido Cove, 9 leagues from the bay, and the last port for riverboats until the old Spanish Channel was dredged and put back into service. The passengers would have to wait until 6 o'clock in the morning to board the fleet of sloops for hire that would carry them to their final destination. But Florentino Ariza was so eager that he sailed much earlier on the mail sloop, whose crew acknowledged him as one of their own. Before he left the boat, he succumbed to the temptation of a symbolic act. He threw his petate into the water and followed it with his eyes as it floated past the beacon lights of the invisible fishermen, left the lagoon, and disappeared in the ocean. He was sure he would not need it again for all the rest of his days. Never again, because never again would he abandon the city of Fermina Daza. The bay was calm at daybreak. Above the floating mist, Florentino Ariza saw the dome of the cathedral, gilded by the first light of dawn. He saw the dovecotes on the flat roofs, and orienting himself by them, he located the balcony of the palace of the Marquis de Casalduero, where he supposed that the lady of his misfortune was still dozing, her head on the shoulder of her satiated husband. That idea broke his heart, but he did nothing to suppress it. On the contrary, he took pleasure in his pain. The sun was beginning to grow hot as the mail sloop made its way through the labyrinth of sailing ships that lay at anchor, where the countless odors from the public market and the decaying matter on the bottom of the bay blended into one pestilential stench. The schooner from Riohacha had just arrived, and gangs of stevedores in water up to their waists lifted the passengers over the side and carried them to shore. Florentino Ariza was the first to jump on land from the mail sloop, and from that time on, he no longer detected the fetid reek of the bay and the city, but was aware only of the personal fragrance of Fermina Daza. Everything smelled of her. He did not return to the telegraph office. His only interest seemed to be the serialized love novels and the volumes of the popular library that his mother continued to buy for him, and that he continued to read again and again, lying in his hammock, until he learned them by heart. He did not even ask for his violin. He re-established relations with his closest friends, and sometimes they played billiards or conversed in the outdoor cafes under the arches around the plaza of the cathedral, but he did not go back to the Saturday night dances. He could not conceive of them without her. On the morning of his return from his inconclusive journey, he learned that Fermina Daza was spending her honeymoon in Europe, and his agitated heart took it for granted that she would live there, if not forever, then for many years to come. This certainty filled him with his first hope of forgetting. He thought of Rosalba, whose memory burned brighter as the others dimmed. It was during this time that he grew the mustache with the wax tips that he would keep for the rest of his life and that changed his entire being. And the idea of substituting one love for another carried him along surprising paths. Little by little, the fragrance of Fermina Daza became less frequent and less intense, and at last it remained only in white gardenias. One night during the war, when he was drifting, not knowing what direction his life should take, the celebrated widow Nazareth took refuge in his house because hers had been destroyed by cannon fire during the siege by the rebel general Ricardo Gaitán Obeso. It was Tránsito Arisa who took control of the situation and sent the widow to her son's bedroom on the pretext that there was no space in hers, but actually in the hope that another love would cure him of the one that did not allow him to live. Florentino Arisa had not made love since he lost his virginity to Rosalba in the cabin on the boat, and in this emergency it seemed natural to him that the widow should sleep in the bed and he in the hammock. But she had already made the decision for him. She sat on the edge of the bed where Florentino Arisa was lying, not knowing what to do, and she began to speak to him of her inconsolable grief for the husband who had died 3 years earlier, and in the meantime, she removed her widow's weeds and tossed them in the air until she was not even wearing her wedding ring. She took off the taffeta blouse with the beaded embroidery and threw it across the room onto the easy chair in the corner. She tossed her bodice over her shoulder to the other side of the bed. With one pull, she removed her long, ruffled skirt, her satin garter belt, and funereal stockings, and she threw everything on the floor until the room was carpeted with the last remnants of her mourning. She did it with so much joy and with such well-measured pauses that each of her gestures seemed to be saluted by the cannon of the attacking troops, which shook the city down to its foundations. Florentino Arisa tried to help her unfasten her stays, but she anticipated him with a deft maneuver, for in 5 years of matrimonial devotion, she learned to depend on herself in all phases of love, even the preliminary stages, with no help from anyone. Then she removed her lace panties, sliding them down her legs with the rapid movements of a swimmer, and at last she was naked. She was 28 years old and had given birth 3 times, but her naked body preserved intact the giddy excitement of an unmarried woman. Florentino Arisa was never to understand how a few articles of penitential clothing could have hidden the drives of that wild mare who, choking on her own feverish desire, undressed him as she had never been able to undress her husband, who would have thought her perverse, and tried, with the confusion and innocence of 5 years of conjugal fidelity, to satisfy in a single assault the iron abstinence of her mourning. Before that night, and from the hour of grace when her mother gave birth to her, she had never even been in the same bed with any man other than her dead husband. She did not permit herself the vulgarity of remorse. On the contrary, kept awake by the gunfire whizzing over the roofs, she continued to evoke her husband's excellent qualities until daybreak, not reproaching him for any disloyalty other than his having died without her, which was mitigated by her conviction that he had never belonged to her as much as he did now that he was in the coffin nailed shut with a dozen 3-inch nails and 2 meters under the ground.
I am happy, she said, because only now do I know for certain where he is when he is not at home. That night, she stopped wearing mourning once and for all, without passing through the useless intermediate stage of blouses with little gray flowers, and her life was filled with love songs and provocative dresses decorated with macaws and spotted butterflies, and she began to share her body with anyone who cared to ask for it. When the troops of General Gaetano Besso were defeated after a 63-day siege, she rebuilt the house that had been damaged by cannon fire, adding a beautiful sea terrace that overlooked the breakwater where the surf would vent its fury during the stormy season. That was her love nest, as she called it without irony, where she would receive only men she liked, when she liked, how she liked, and without charging one red cent. Because in her opinion, it was the men who were doing her the favor. In a very few cases she would accept a gift, as long as it was not made of gold, and she managed everything with so much skill that no one could have presented conclusive evidence of improper conduct. On only one occasion did she hover on the edge of public scandal, when the rumor circulated that Archbishop Dante della Luna had not died by accident after eating a plate of poisonous mushrooms, but had eaten them intentionally, because she threatened to expose him if he persisted in his sacrilegious solicitations. As she used to say between peals of laughter, she was the only free woman in the province. The widow Nazaret never missed her occasional appointments with Florentino Arisa, not even during her busiest times, and it was always without pretensions of loving or being loved, although always in the hope of finding something that resembled love, but without the problems of love. Sometimes he went to her house, and then they liked to sit on the sea terrace, drenched by salt spray, watching the dawn of the whole world on the horizon. With all his perseverance, he tried to teach her the tricks he had seen others perform through the peepholes in the transient hotel, along with the theoretical formulations preached by Lothario Tugut on his nights of debauchery. He persuaded her to let themselves be observed while they made love, to replace the conventional missionary position with the bicycle on the sea, or the chicken on the grill, or the drawn and quartered angel, and they almost broke their necks when the cord snapped as they were trying to devise something new in a hammock. The lessons were to no avail. The truth is that she was a fearless apprentice, but lacked all talent for guided fornication. She never understood the charm of serenity in bed, never had a moment of invention, and her orgasms were inopportune and epidermic, an uninspired lay. For a long time, Florentino Arisa lived with the deception that he was the only one, and she humored him in that belief until she had the bad luck to talk in her sleep. Little by little, listening to her sleep, he pieced together the navigation chart of her dreams and sailed among the countless islands of her secret life. In this way, he learned that she did not want to marry him, but did feel joined to his life because of her immense gratitude to him for having corrupted her. She often said to him, "I adore you because you made me a whore." Said in another way, she was right. Florentino Arisa had stripped her of the virginity of a conventional marriage, more pernicious than congenital virginity or the abstinence of widowhood. He had taught her that nothing one does in bed is immoral if it helps to perpetuate love, and something else that from that time on would be her reason for living. He convinced her that one comes into the world with a predetermined allotment of lays, and whoever does not use them for whatever reason, one's own or someone else's, willingly or unwillingly, loses them forever. It was to her credit that she took him at his word. Still, because he thought he knew her better than anyone else, Florentino Arisa could not understand why a woman of such puerile resources should be so popular. A woman, moreover, who never stopped talking in bed about the grief she felt for her dead husband. The only explanation he could think of, one that could not be denied, was that the widow Nazaret had enough tenderness to make up for what she lacked in the marital arts, They began to see each other with less frequency as she widened her horizons and he exploited his, trying to find solace in other hearts for his pain, and at last, with no sorrow, they forgot each other. That was Florentino Ariza's first bedroom love. But instead of their forming a permanent union, of the kind his mother dreamed about, both used it to embark on a profligate way of life. Florentino Ariza developed methods that seemed incredible in someone like him, taciturn and thin, and dressed like an old man from another time. He had two advantages working in his favor, however. One was an unerring eye that promptly spotted the woman, even in a crowd, who was waiting for him. Though even then, he courted her with caution, for he felt that nothing was more embarrassing or more demeaning than a refusal. The other was that women promptly identified him as a solitary man in need of love, a street beggar as humble as a whipped dog, who made them yield without conditions, without asking him for anything, without hoping for anything from him except the tranquility of knowing they had done him a favor. These were his only weapons, and with them he joined in historic battles of absolute secrecy, which he recorded with the rigor of a notary in a coded book, recognizable, among many others, by the title that said everything. Women. His first notation was the widow Nazaret. 50 years later, when Fermina Daza was freed from her sacramental sentence, he had some 25 notebooks, with 622 entries of long-term liaisons, apart from the countless fleeting adventures that did not even deserve a charitable note. After 6 months of furious lovemaking with the widow Nazaret, Florentino Ariza himself was convinced that he had survived the torment of Fermina Daza. He not only believed it, he also discussed it several times with Tránsito Ariza during the 2 years of Fermina Daza's wedding trip, and he continued to believe it with a feeling of boundless freedom until one fateful Sunday when,